Welcome, gentle listeners, to the Daily Nightly, a Jane Austen journey, where we'll be reading the collected works of Jane Austen and exploring her influence in pop culture. We are your humble servants. I'm Annie, a.k.a.
And I'm Jessie.
And today we are talking about chapters 46 through 50 of Jane Austen, Sense and Sensibility. We did it!
I really want to take a moment to acknowledge that we finished what we started. And we've completed one of Jane Austen's books, and we had a great time doing it. We figured out some technical stuff along the way, but I feel like we deserve to take this moment and give ourselves a round of applause. A pat on the back, if you will.
Pat on the back, round of applause, internet high five.
Yeah, like, good for us. Good here. You know, how many people start stuff and don't finish it?
I know, we've been going for months, too.
I know, it was warm out here when we started.
I'm literally under a wool blanket right now.
Oh, that's smart. I have the heat, like, blasting. My cat's very mad at me.
Oh, no. I'm very proud of us. And, like, there was something so satisfying about reading that the end.
Oh, I know. Well, at first I was like, is that it?
But we'll definitely get to that ending.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I'm proud of us. And I'm proud of our listeners that have kept going and finished the book along with us. It's an accomplishment to finish a book. I was telling Annie how I got to update my Goodreads account to say I finished the book. And it really, that's such a sense of accomplishment.
It's satisfying in a dopamine kind of way.
It is, yeah. So round of applause to everyone. Good job, us. We finished a book.
We have just a couple more to go, but I mean, I think I'm very impressed with us.
Yeah, so I wanted to take a moment to recognize that.
It honestly just makes me more excited for what's to come.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited. Yeah. But anyway.
Before we get to all that, though.
Yes, before.
What have you been doing outside of the world of Austen lately?
Yeah, so I'm going to try to be chill about this, but it's a little hard for me. So
chill is not your middle name.
No, it's not. No. So I think it was about 8 years ago, a long time ago, I read a book called The Night Circus by Aaron Morgenstern. And I don't want to be dramatic or hyperbolic about this, but it basically changed my life. It's a book about a magical circus that shows up random places with tents and there's people and a love story. And it's just very much, you know, my shit. Like, a book that was, like, written just for me. It's kind of how I felt. Like, I actually think I hugged it when I finished it. Like, I sat for a moment and was like, wow, like, I love this book. Like, I feel about this book. Like, I feel about people that I love. I think I actually wrote the author a fan letter, which I've only done once since. I don't think I heard back from her, although I did receive a signed copy in the mail. But I never heard back from her. I know, but anyway, fast forward to a couple weeks ago, Aaron Morgenstern came out with her second novel, and it's been long awaited because it's been a fair amount of time since she published The Night Circus. And her second book is called The Starless Sea, and of course I pre-ordered it so I could have it the day that it came. And I think maybe I liked it better than The Night Circus. Our main character is this graduate student named Zachary. He's getting his degree in his writing's thesis about video games, so there's very funny, like, allusions to video games and virtual reality, and he's an introvert like me, likes books like me, like you, Annie, and he's lovely, and his mother's a fortune teller, and he goes on this journey, mm-hmm. And there's a magical library, there's fairy tales, there's magic, and there's love stories, and it's just stories within stories within stories. It's sort of like one of those Russian nesting dolls of stories, and they all sort of come together at the end in a really complimentary way. And I just, like, fell in love with it. It was just, like, with The Night Circus, it really felt like it was made for me. I'd found, like, a piece of my soul in a book out there, and I just loved it so much. I understand it's not for everybody, particularly I keep recommending The Night Circus, and I get a lot of people that say, you know, it wasn't for me. I don't think it lends itself really well to an audiobook format or even an ebook format, because part of the fun is flipping back and forth and looking at previous pages and rereading certain stories. So I do recommend if you read it to maybe get a physical copy of the book from your library or local bookstore or Amazon, whatever, which I did. But anyway, but I loved it. It was just a really nice experience, and I can't wait to reread it.
That sounds wonderful, especially with how excited you are about it.
I know. I feel like I've read a lot of books that I've loved this year, and I can't even say if it's my favorite book that I've read this year, honestly, but it's maybe the one that I felt the most connected to, really.
Don't you love it? when that happens.
I know, it's, oh, I just love books so much.
That makes me think of this quote from The History Boys, which is a play by Alan Bennett. I've never seen the play, but I love the movie so much for some reason that I even bought a copy of the script. And there's this line where the English professor is talking to the boys and he says, "The best moments in reading are when you come across something, a thought, a feeling, a way of looking at things, which you had thought special and particular to you. Now here it is, set down by someone else, a person you have never met, someone who is even long dead. And it is as if a hand has come out to you and taken yours."
Oh my god, I love that.
That's what it makes me think of sometimes when I hear you talk about books.
Oh gosh, that's like a really high compliment. Thank you. I know, I just, it's reading. There's something about reading where I can just like, I can just lose myself in it more than any other medium.
I don't know. It's just something that like connects all the humanity in us, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and all the things that you never would experience, but also you kind of, you still get it anyways.
And speaking of other media, just a shout out. I saw Frozen 2 this week. Ooh. And I had a lot of fun. I mean, whatever. I love Disney movies with singing, blah, blah, blah. But actually, it made me think of Sense and Sensibility because it's about sisters. And I know. And one sister is the younger sister, and she's maybe a little bit more passionate and exuberant with her feelings. The other sister is very more controlled and don't let it show. Like, don't let what you're feeling show. And the movies, you know, there are some love interests, but ultimately both Frozen 1 and Frozen 2 are about the love that sisters have for each other. And it really made me think about Sense and Sensibility and the love that Eleanor and Marianne have for each other. And even though, like, the men kind of take over the plot towards the end, it really is about them and their complementary personalities. And I just wanted to make that connection.
Oh, they really are Marianne and Eleanor.
I know.
That's so sweet. I got a little chill with you talking about it. But also, again, I am cold.
No, okay, well. But anyway, that's literally enough for me. Annie, what media are you consuming lately?
Well, it's been kind of a crazy couple of weeks with life and everything. So I haven't had a lot of, I feel like I say this every week, but haven't had much time to sit and just like read. I did finish The Deep by River Solomon, which I did enjoy. There was a lot, it was just a beautiful world that I wish I could have gotten more of, but there's something in its brevity that's kind of really stark and wonderful and resonant. I thought, it's this whole wonderful discussion about carrying the weight. I think I said this last week too, about carrying the weight of your people's history and what it means for you, but also still having that, still being able to find yourself among it and being able to share the emotional burdens that you all carry. So I thought that was a really lovely one. I actually recommended it to a friend who has a 12-year-old daughter who reads everything. So I'm very excited to actually have like our own little mini book club about it.
Oh, that's adorable.
Yeah. And everything else, honestly, it's been things that I've just kind of watched when I had some time, like the most recent episode of The Good Place about Chidi and how he became so enamored with books and learning and finding the answers, which I related to and also wanted to cry while watching. I've been watching his Dark Materials miniseries, which has been really interesting talking to people who've read the book as opposed to my experience as someone who hasn't read them. You know, The Mandalorian has been a thing. Actually, oh, no, God. I know what happened. Disney Plus has eaten my brain and my time. That's what happened.
I mean, I talked about Frozen.
For some reason, it's everything I've wanted in a streaming service. Also, we were talking about it earlier, but I got to see Knives Out last night, which I know you saw a while ago. I love a good, thick, meaty murder mystery with all these characters. And I'm 100% biased because one of the main characters is also a nurse. So that was a good time.
Oh, yeah. And it's about, like, you know, money and fights over money, just like Sense and Sensibility kind of.
Yes. And then, you know, there's something about when you have like one character who's so deeply entrenched in plots and creating murder mysteries himself and how it lends to everything else in his life. And the movie reflects that. Oh, it's so fun. I love a good story like that. But I am going to start reading The Gentleman's Guide to Vice and Virtue by Mackenzie Lee, who also wrote a book that I own and haven't started because most books I haven't started. It's the Marvel tie-in book about Loki when he was a kid. It is called Where Mischief Lies.
Oh, that sounds good. I've heard really good things about A Gentleman in Virtue, so.
Me too. I'm excited. I'm going to force myself to read it because of self-care. But the thing I am currently obsessed with other than Knives Out is the trailer for the new Emma adaptation.
Oh, gasp. New Emma.
New Emma. I mean, there's been the Gwyneth Paltrow one, which is, I guess, is like the definitive one for a lot of people.
It's pretty good.
It is very good. It's very charming. And then there was one a couple years ago starring Romola Gary as Emma and Johnny Lee Miller as Mr. Knightley. Also good. Two fantastic, charming leads. This one is directed by Autumn de Wilde, starring Anna Taylor-Joy, who is indeed an actual joy. And as Mr. Knightley, Johnny Flynn.
In case you don't know, Annie is a major fan of Johnny Flynn.
I love it. That man can do Shakespeare. He can do comedy. He's a little awkward. He can do like blues and folk music. And he has been violin stuff. My favorite is when he plays a violin. And he does it in the trailer. So yeah, that's happening.
Anna Taylor-Joy, I know her mostly from like horror movies, right? She's in is she in The Witch?
The Witch.
And then Thoroughbreds, which isn't really a horror movie, but it kind of is. I mean, it's about like murdery girls.
That's scary.
But yeah, but
Split. She's also in Split.
Yeah, exactly. And so she's always in these sort of like horror movies. And so I kind of associate her with like murder. So like I'm looking at this photo and I mean, I think she makes a great Emma. Like first of all, Emma's one of my favorite. I love Emma and I love Cher Horowitz, but anyway, we'll get there. She just like looks like she's going to murder someone. And I was like, you know what? I would watch a version of Emma where Emma straight up murders everybody and it would be great. So I'm very much looking forward to her Emma, and getting to Emma and Emma with you.
There's a worry that maybe it might be a little too sexy, because as we know, I don't like my Austin too sexy. But at some point, Knightley takes a shirt off, and I went, that's fine.
I mean, we'll get to this when we get to Pride and Prejudice. But I'm fine with that.
There will be so much eye rolling at me when we get there.
Yeah, there's like barely any kissing in Jane Austen like movies and adaptions, so...
There really isn't. I think they use the phrase make love at some point, and it's definitely not how we use it nowadays.
No. Yeah, there's a quote at the end of Sense and Sensibility I want to talk about, too, that makes me think of. Anyway, I'm good. Carpet before the horse. Emma, coming up.
It's going to happen, guys. It's going to be great. Or really embarrassing for us. I mean, I guess before we go into what happened in the last five chapters of Sense and Sensibility, we may as well just catch up on what's been happening up until then. Previously on Sense and Sensibility, when we last left the Dashwood sisters, minus Margaret, as usual, things were still looking kind of glum. The love of Eleanor's life was set to marry her nemesis, Lucy Steele, and Marianne had caught a cold. We did have the rather intense revelation that Willoughby did in fact love Marianne and felt pretty bad about what he did to her. And opens his heart to Eleanor, who listens to him better than either of us would have because we are not as good people. He leaves and Marianne starts to get better, helped by the arrival of her mother, who is fetched by the lovely, very lovely Colonel Brandon, who actually is a colonel.
I'm sorry, I couldn't help myself.
Today I had a really fun conversation with one of the doctors I work with, and we were talking about Galaxy Quest, that's what happened, and he said, you know, Alan Rickman... If he were better looking, he just would have been the biggest star. I'm like, he kind of was.
If he was better looking. Oh, harsh.
Right? Anyways, we can't really handle all that charisma and charm and talent on top of, like, being better looking than he already was, which was more than fine. Anyways, what happened?
Oh, gosh.
At the end of this book, Jesse.
Kind of jam-packed chapters, right? And everybody.
Oh, goodness, yes.
Okay, so the Dashwoods finally return back to Barton Cottage, and Marianne continues to recover from her illness. She and Eleanor go for a walk one day, and the subject of Willoughby's broached again. Marianne admits that she behaved rather imprudently in their relationship with him, but Eleanor consoles her by relating Willoughby's confession. Marianne feels much better, knowing that his abandonment of her was not the final revelation of a long-standing deceit, but rather the result of his financial problems, and was thus not entirely ill-willed. Marianne also acknowledges that she never would have been happy with him anyway, and he's proven himself rather lacking in integrity. Eleanor shares Willoughby's confession with Mrs. Dashwood as well, who pities him but cannot fully forgive him for his treatment of Marianne, understandably. Thomas, the Dashwoods' manservant, arrives from town with the news that, quote, Mr. Ferrers has married Lucy Steele. This news distresses both Marianne and Eleanor. Marianne falls into a fit of hysterics, because of course she does, and Eleanor appears deeply disappointed. Witnessing her eldest daughter's grief, Mrs. Dashwood wonders whether she ought to pay to have closer attention to Eleanor's feelings over the past months. You think, Mrs. Dashwood? Not long after, Eleanor thinks she sees Colonel Brandon approaching, but no, it's Edward. When he enters the house, her and Marianne inquire about his recent marriage, and he realizes there's been a misunderstanding and assures them that it was Robert who married Lucy Steele. So Robert, who's the heir to Mrs. Ferrer's money, and when Lucy found out, she shifted her affections to the richer, Ferrer brother. Eleanor is so overcome with relief that she runs out of the room, unable to contain her tears of joy. Within the next 3 hours, Edward proposes to Eleanor, and she accepts because, of course, she does, with great happiness. Over dinner that evening, he shares the unfortunate circumstances which led to his engagement to Lucy. Edward also shares with the Dashwood sisters a note from Lucy in which she informed him of her engagement to Robert and severed all romantic ties with him. When Colonel Brandon arrives at Barton and hears the news of their engagement, he graciously offers to improve the parsonage at Delaford to accommodate the couple comfortably. Mrs. Ferrers ultimately reconciles herself to Edward's new situation, though she continues to favor Robert as if he were the eldest son. Eleanor and Edward live together at Delaford and frequently invite both Marianne and Colonel Brandon to visit in the hope that the two of them will form an attachment with one another. Their plan is successful, for the Colonel and the younger sister become engaged and move in with Eleanor and Edward. The sisters continue to maintain close ties with their mother and Margaret, remember Margaret, at Barton Cottage, and the families live happily ever after. The end.
We got there. Somehow we got there.
It all came, like, I couldn't believe how quickly and, like, kind of tied with a bow that it came out.
On the one hand, I kind of expected that because then there were so few chapters left, but at the same time, it's like, okay, here we are. Everyone's married now.
Yeah, the end.
Jane still manages to get a lot of humor in there, too, which I kind of love. But yeah, it just seemed like we turned around. We're like, because last week we were just like, how are we going to resolve all of this?
That's true. We did say
in
that.
In so little time. We were very concerned.
No, and I was even concerned before we got to the last chapter. I was like, okay, like Edward and Eleanor are happy, but what about Marianne? Yeah, it did kind of come together really quickly in the last chapter.
This does sort of explain like some of what I do remember from the adaptations where you're like suddenly like, whoa, wait, now Marianne and Brandon are married. It's like, oh, because that's how it happens in the book. That's how she wrote it.
No, but I really liked the Eleanor stuff. But anyway, so going back, we have Marianne's getting better and Eleanor tells Marianne about Willoughby. What did you think about Marianne's reaction to Willoughby's confession to Eleanor?
You know what? I thought it was very measured for a woman of her many years at 17. Was it 17 or 18 now?
Is she 17? Yeah.
17, having really, truly lived. You know, she's just so wise. I appreciated that she was actually, that she did obviously have feelings about it. But she had found herself in this place where she can be like, yep, I have made a choice. I'm going to be okay. Not in a weird way where I'm lying. Not in a weird way where I'm like constantly freaking out and crying all the time. I have done my thing. I'm going to just move on. And I really like that. It showed a lot of growth for her, I think.
No, that's exactly what I was thinking. That she, it showed a lot of growth. You could, a lot of things happened in this chapter that she says that I was really impressed with her. I think she says that, you know, my illness, I know, has been entirely brought on by myself, by my negligence, my own health, which is, you know, everybody, like, stopped their lives to take care of her. She was so sick, and she acknowledges that she did it to herself, really, and I think that that acknowledgement kind of goes a long way in her growth process. And I think what really got me is when she's talking to Eleanor, and she says, you know, I compare my reaction to what it should have been. It should have been like your reaction, kind of referencing how Eleanor was so stoic when it came to Edward moving on. And Eleanor sort of concedes, like, our situations bore little resemblance, which may or may not be true. But Eleanor is able to see that, okay, you know, the way Marianne handled things might not have been great, but maybe the way I handled things might not have been the best way either, and we can just kind of, like, move on, and we don't need to compare our reactions to each other.
Definitely. She is still Marianne, though, so I still really loved that. You know, this whole thing where she keeps going, like, had I died, this is what would happen. She was basically like, just, if I had died, how much trouble I would have caused, how sad everyone would be, how everyone would be, like, so miserable, how you would have to, like, remember me, and how you'd have to console Mom because she'd be so bereft, the loss of me.
That's
I thought
point.
That was hysterical. But at the same time, it was very, she has shown signs before of being very thoughtful of the people around her, especially the ones that she loved beyond just the romantic sense. So I think it's just kind of her coming into being, you know, being that person she always had the potential to be.
Yeah, and she says, I think it's in the next chapter, you know, like, I never could have been happy with him. Like, eventually I would have found out about all this. Because even if we can excuse his treatment of her, we can't really, I think we talked about this last time, we can't excuse his treatment of Eliza, Colonel Brandon's ward. It's just, like, horrible what he did to her, and eventually that news would have come out to Marianne, and what would she have done with this man that she loved, knowing all of this? And was that, Eleanor says something like, had you married, you might have always been poor. His expensiveness is acknowledged even by himself, and his whole conduct declares his self-denial is a word hardly understood by him.
What did you think about Eleanor just suddenly revealing everything that she's felt about him?
Right, it's always like a struggle, right, when your friend's dating someone that you don't like, and then they break up, and you're like, I never liked him, he was a deadbeat, and you like go off on, and then they start dating again, like immediately after, and you're like, wow, like I wish I hadn't said all those things. So it is kind of a delicate balance, but I think Eleanor is in a spot where Willoughby's not going to come back, so it's, and Marianne has sort of washed her hands with him. It's just sort of reinforcing to Marianne that she made the right call, even though Marianne does seem a little taken aback by it.
It did make me laugh because we do know that Eleanor can be fairly judgmental, and she tries really hard to hold things in because she knows it's the right thing to do, but at the same time you're like, your inner monologue must be amazing.
Yeah, she's talking about Willoughby and she calls him like selfish, and Marianne's like, selfish? And I love this quote. I think she like kind of like, I think this is what you're sort of alluding to when she didn't hold back her feelings. What did she say? The whole of his behavior, replied Eleanor, from the beginning to the end of the affair has been grounded on selfishness. It was selfishness which first made him sport with your affections. Afterwards, when his own were engaged, made him delay the confession of it, and which finally carried him from Barton. His own enjoyment or his own ease was in every particular his ruling principle. And it's true, because even him confessing all of this stuff to Eleanor was selfish, really.
It's because he felt uncomfortable or ill at ease, not because he genuinely, truly, actually felt sorry for Marianne.
It's about himself. It's always about himself. Even his feelings for Marianne have always been about himself.
Nothing about what he can offer her. It's all about how she made him feel.
Oh, I think you hit the nail right on the head of grossness there.
But I did like when it said Marianne's lips quivered and she repeated the word selfish in a tone that implied, do you really think him selfish?
Oh, Marianne.
So sweet. Because it is kind of one of those things of like, well, I liked him and you didn't. So am I wrong? Am I just like him? Oh, no. When you said you hit the nail on the head, it's actually not my idea, because Marianne actually says, it is very true, my happiness was never his object.
Ah, so Marianne comes to the self-actualization by herself.
Our little girl is growing up.
But there are some things that happen later in this chapter to indicate that maybe Marianne hasn't, like, fully grown up. Like, when we hear about Edward having gotten married and she, like, freaks out. Marianne gave a violent start, fixed her eyes upon Eleanor, saw her turning pale, and fell back in her chair in hysterics. Marianne, girlfriend, calm down.
Still having to one-up Eleanor just a tiny bit.
Yeah, even though it's Eleanor, the one that's, like, the boy she loves is, like, married.
I think last time you were... talking about the purpose of Marianne getting sick, we vaguely came to the conclusion that it kind of put her out of the way and moved everyone else into the place that we needed them to be for the ending, or the ending that we supposed. But it does seem like for both, not even just for Marianne, but also for Willoughby, it gave them these kind of revelations that have led them to their ending as well, which is maybe it wasn't, we weren't giving Jane enough credit, but that's actually, it was a really nice how she did it as quickly as she did it.
So it not only moved the chess pieces further, but I also think that we're seeing a lot of growth with Marianne that might not have come if she hadn't gotten sick, because I do think she really, like, as dramatic as she still is, she understands, you know, like, I made myself sick. I did this to myself, and I was sort of being, I don't know, what's a better word than silly, self-indulgent, or she recognizes that the impulses that led her to this point may not have been the best. And so I think that's a huge amount of growth, even if she still is Marianne.
Do you think she would have gotten to this point eventually if she hadn't gotten sick?
I mean, I'd like to think so. I mean, it's hard, right? Because maybe her being sick is the impetus behind Willoughby, like, making all these declarations to Eleanor, in which case maybe Marianne wouldn't have ever found out about it, mm-hmm. because Willoughby never would have come, because she wouldn't have been sick. So I do see the purpose of her getting sick, but I do think eventually, and we'll get to some of the end quotes, because I think Jane does proselytize a little bit at the end. I think she goes on this thing about how Marianne changed, and a lot of the things that she said at the beginning that were a little bit off, she rectified. I think that Marianne was always sort of meant to change, and the sickness was maybe a way to quicken that.
I like it. I hope, I too hope she would have grown up. You know, it may have taken a little bit more time. She may not have moved, maybe... I do, like, part of me wonders, like, if it would have been harder for her to move on if she hadn't heard his story.
Mm.
But I like that she's, like, come to peace at it, you know, found some sympathy in him and closed the book and was able to move on. And she moved on to the dashing Colonel Brandon.
Which we'll get to. I have things to say about that.
Ooh, intriguing.
So we also get the news that, like, Eleanor's, like, impatient to hear about Edward, and we finally get the knowledge that he is allegedly married, and that's kind of over for her, and mm-hmm. it's a pretty big bummer. But the thing that got me the most is when Mrs. Dashwood finds out about all of this, and she mm-hmm. starts to feel very bad. There's definitely a moment where their quote-unquote silly mother has a reflective step back and begins to wonder that just because Marianne was a little bit more outward with her emotion, that she completely missed the fact that her other daughter was suffering just as much.
Marianne's the squeaky wheel.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this so much throughout this book. I mean, Eleanor, it's part of, like, who she is. It's part of her role, not just being the strong one, but at least appearing to be the strong one, even when she really doesn't want to be. Mm-hmm. And who can blame Mrs. Dashwood for going, like, oh, Eleanor's fine. Marianne needs help. She's, like, our more delicate one.
That's true. And what I like about it is that it is a little sad. I think I put, like, a sad face next to this in my book in the margin. And it is sad, and it's a sad moment for the reader to kind of remember, because Mrs. Dashwood has been sidelined through a lot of the book. So I think it's really nice that Jane does sort of have Mrs. Dashwood recognize this, and you wish that Mrs. Dashwood might have been more there for her other daughter. But at the same time, I think it shows growth in Mrs. Dashwood's character as well, and it sort of gives us a little bit of growth for her too, maybe?
She has her own little story. I was going to say, she's lost her husband at the beginning of this book. Let her have something too.
No, that's true. And it can't be easy to be, you know, the mother to these daughters. And, you know, you always want them to be happy. And the fact that they're relatively poor is sort of a hindrance to them, you know, marrying well, marrying the people that they love. So I can see how that might weigh on her.
Speaking of their being poor, though, I did make a note here about how they found out that Mr. Ferrers was married. And I gotta say, there was a moment where when we got to the Mr. Ferrers part, I was like, he didn't say Edward. He didn't say Edward, so maybe it's Robert. But why would he marry Lucy? I totally don't understand it. And then he was in the carriage being very quiet and like, what did he say? He was never a gentleman much for talking. And I went, oh, that does sound like Edward. Maybe I'm
wrong. Oh, yeah. No, it was super weird because they do leave it open, but you're like, why would Robert marry Lucy?
It makes no sense at all. Even though earlier we talked about how there was a similarity between Robert and Lucy that was very off-putting.
That's true. They only cared about, like, money.
Vanity and appearance and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Not great. The thing that kind of struck me was they're so poorly off, but at the same time, they're manservant Thomas was the one who reported back from some errand in Exeter and brought back the information. And I just kept writing the manservant in like all caps because I was like, we can't forget the fact that not only do they have a staff. When Marianne falls back in her chair in hysterics at the news, the manservant gets, quote, one of the maids, plural.
Oh, I missed that completely.
It just struck me so funny. I went, okay. I'm readjusting my idea of where they live once again. Not a huge mansion, but also cottages in air quotes.
No, that's true. I mean, we've talked about money a lot, and it's really just so hard to grasp exactly where they are in the mm-hmm. social strata. But I guess they're probably more like middle class. And the problem is that they're not the sons or whatever, and they mm-hmm. don't have an inheritance. That's more the problem than... they're like destitute.
Yeah, they're just about comfortable, but they're still in a position where getting married is a necessary occupation, I guess. It's their job. Is that safe to say?
Yeah. No, I think I think that's accurate. No, I always consider them like poor too, and I'm like, wait, no. Mm-hmm.
They are in a position where they can still like consider marrying for love though, and that's definitely what Eleanor was hoping for with Edward. At the beginning of chapter 48, it says she now found that in spite of herself, she had always admitted a hope while Edward remained single, that something would occur to prevent his marrying Lucy. That is such a fantastical thing. That's based on absolutely no real evidence. It's a very Marianne thing of her to do.
Oh, yeah, that's true. No, I was really gutted by that whole beginning of chapter 48 because I think before that, she sort of is grappling with expecting an unpleasant event to happen versus being told about it and how mm-hmm. just so much worse it is when it actually happens, even though you know it's going to happen.
Yeah, that tiny kernel of hope is so much more powerful than we tend to give it credit for, isn't it?
No, yeah. And I think I think you and I were kind of expecting something to happen too. And I mean, notwithstanding that like something unexpected does end up happening, but I think you and I were both sort of counting on something like that to happen where Edward would come back to Eleanor. And it does, but even though it does, I don't think you get to discount the fact that for a few pages here, we think that, and we're supposed to think that Edward got married to Lucy.
It was definitely a bit of a gut punch when I saw that, even though there's still that part of me going, maybe it was Robert. It was probably Robert. It doesn't sound like Robert.
Oh, I love that Eleanor's like really mad that she's not hearing about anything. And so she like blames her. She goes, though uncertain that anyone were to blame, she found fault with every absent friend. They were all thoughtless or indolent. Why haven't my friends told me about this?
Why haven't they told me about this even though I've shared nothing with them and didn't tell any of them how important this is to me?
Yeah, can't they read my mind?
Oh.
How many times have you, like, sat there and been like, can't anyone tell that I'm upset? Like, no one can because you, like, didn't tell anyone.
I need someone to witness my quiet, noble struggle.
Right? No, that's exactly what Eleanor's thinking. And you're right, it is fantastical. That's, like, definitely, like, a Marianne type thing, even though Marianne would be showing it.
And it is also a very Marianne thing to just burst into tears when she found out that, no, that's Robert. You're thinking Robert. Robert married Lucy. Oh, she's God. Mrs. Robert Ferrars.
We have to talk about this, like, whole scene because I, like, could not believe when I read it. First of all, like, remember when Colonel Brandon was approaching on horseback, but Marianne thought it was Willoughby and, like, freaked out about it? And we have, like, mm-hmm. a reversal here because Eleanor thinks it's Colonel Brandon, but then it turns out to be Edward.
There's a lot of mistaken people, like, arriving in the mists and getting it wrong, because also when Eleanor thought that Brandon had returned with her mom and it was Willoughby, with surprising the crap out of all of us. Because I actually have in my notes, like, Brandon's coming to visit. Colonel Brandon must have some information to give. And I wrote, wait, no, he's here now on horseback. No, hold on, it's Edward.
But, like, this whole thing, when he comes in, he's like, no, it was my brother. And then everyone, like, freaks out. Like, Eleanor's just like, I have to get out of here. And, like, leaves to, like, cry and, like, be, like, happy cry. I wrote down this whole quote because I couldn't believe it when I read it. Edward, mm-hmm. who had till then looked anywhere rather than at her, saw her hurry away and perhaps saw or even heard her emotions, for immediately afterwards he fell into a reverie which no remarks, no inquiries, no affectionate address of Mrs. Dashwood's could penetrate. and at last, without saying a word, quitted the room and walked out towards the village, leaving the others in the greatest astonishment and perplexity on a change in his situation so wonderful and so sudden, a perplexity which they had no means of lessening by their own conjectures. I can picture it so clearly in my mind.
I love, because, like, right as he showed up, before, you know, she falls away in tears of happiness, she tells herself, I will become.
Yeah.
I will be mistress of myself.
She gives herself a pep talk. It's so good.
It's good to know some things haven't changed over the years where you're like, you're going to be okay. It's going to be fine. You will not cry.
Do you give yourself pep talks, like, before work and stuff?
Absolutely. There's a giant yeah. on my door and I go, this is going to be fine.
I never needed to do that in my life except before the bar exam. I left myself little post-it notes everywhere that were like, you will pass this test. Like, you will, I think it was like, you will murder this test. So right before, I was like very nervous about throwing up in front of everyone when I walked down the aisle. It's like, I don't know. It was just like, you know, you had these like ridiculous fears in your mind. You're like, I'm going to throw up in front of everybody. And like, it was just like a weird, I was like really scared and to have everybody stare at me. And so we're like, and literally everyone was like, are you okay? Like, you don't even need to walk down the aisle. Like, I was like, no, like, I'll do this. And so right before we start walking and the doors open, my dad turns to me and he goes, just fucking do it. And it worked. I did it.
Oh, good dad.
But so Eleanor runs out of the room in happy tears or whatever. And then Edward like walks away. And then what, like 3 hours later he proposes? Is that like the way the events happened? Like, I was a little unclear.
I did write when he, you know, returns. Talking about how free he was now. And then Edward is free.
Edward is free. Edward is a free elf.
He is. He is a free elf ready to marry. And he does. His errand at Barton, in fact, was a simple one. It was only to ask Eleanor to marry him, and considering that he was not altogether inexperienced in such a question, it might be strange that he should feel so uncomfortable in the present case as he really did. So much in need of encouragement and fresh air.
Oh, I love that.
It's so wonderful because Edward, yes, he's proposed to someone before, apparently. So it should be old hat to him, but he's like, nope, this one matters. This one actually matters. I need a second. God.
That quote was hysterical. I was like laughing so hard, but it was like, and after experiencing the blessings of one imprudent engagement, contracted without his mother's consent, as he had already done for more than 4 years, nothing less could be expected of him in the failure of that than the immediate contraction of another. Like, oh, gotta make another imprudent engagement.
Suddenly we have so much more like humor and charm regarding Edward's story because he's back in our good graces.
3 hours later, he secured the lady, engaged her mother's consent, and was not only in the rapturous profession of the love, but in reality of reason and truth, one of the happiest of men. Yay, Edward! Aww. You did it!
He did it! 3 hours is so specific.
I know. I think it's just such a funny visual that, like, he tells her that he, you know, he's, like, free. And then, like, they both, like, run off to their separate corners and, like, eventually find each other.
They just needed a moment to process. And Marianne could speak her happiness only by tears.
Oh, Marianne. Never changed.
Because she's still Marianne. And I love that once we cross that threshold of, yes, no, you love each other. You love each other. You're getting married now. Cool. Suddenly, can't get anyone to shut up.
I know, Edward, where was all this helpful information chapters ago? And we were like, does Edward even like Eleanor?
We were wondering if he had anything resembling a personality other than talking about weather.
No,
but
God.
It turns out he felt even more like that about Eleanor.
Oh, God.
He was trying to be a good boy.
He has a lot to say, doesn't he?
Oh, goodness.
Do you buy his whole, like, excuse for shacking up with Lucy? He's like always bored.
It's not a very classy explanation.
No, it's not.
But I'm sure it's probably actually true. He's went, I was lonely and bored and felt useless. And here was someone who was paying me attention and really seemed to like me when I'm obviously the black sheep of my family.
Oh God, these quotes are like horrible. It was a foolish, idle inclination on my side, the consequence of ignorance of the world. I should very soon have outgrown the fancied attachment, especially by mixing more with the world. I had therefore nothing in the world to do but to fancy myself in love. And I think this might be my Austin Byrne. She was pretty too, at least I thought so then, and I had seen so little of other women that I could make no comparisons and see no defects.
Wait, I think that wasn't one of mine too.
No, I know. It was so hard to pick a bird because they're like, it was such like a saccharine grouping of chapters that it wasn't like really snarky.
But but at the same time, it's like, don't be so rude.
Yeah.
It's like, I thought she was pretty, but I'd never seen girls before.
Yeah, I know. It's horrible. Oh, at least, and like, it's in italics too, at least in my copy, where he goes, at least she was pretty too. At least I thought so then.
Cold. But at the same time, I kind of can blame her. Because, I mean, there were so many times where I kind of wanted to be somewhat sympathetic to the Steels, because I'm like, I know your only job is to get married. But at the same time, someone would say something like that, and I would go, that's probably fair.
Well, Lucy was mean to Eleanor. Like, she was really mean, like, mean girl to her. So we were a little bit more sympathetic to Lucy than maybe Jane was, but
definitely ultimately more to Lucy than the Dashwoods are about Willoughby.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, ultimately, it, like, ends the way it should with Edward. Although he's still very much like, well, I was still going to marry her, but then I got this letter. What do you think of the letter?
The letter was so cold.
Yeah, it was. You can just burn everything I gave you. Feel free to keep my hair.
No, that one was one of my burns, where she's like, oh, I'll think of you fondly. If we don't stay friends, it won't be because of me. It'll be fine and be wonderful. We can totally, like, make it work. But P.S. I have burnt all your letters and will turn your picture at the first opportunity. Please to destroy my scrawls, but the ring with my hair you are very welcome to keep.
Oh, and he's mad about it. He's like, in a sister it's bad enough, but in a wife, how have I blushed over the pages of her writing?
And he was trying to be such a good boy, too, being like, I was gonna give her an opening to leave after I lost all my opportunity, but she didn't, and I don't know why. Eleanor, being a single woman, being pressured to marry, too, obviously understands. And she says something like, you know, it's better to have kept him on the line and marry him rather than to not marry it at all.
This might be putting salt in the wound, but I really like this bit where Edward's talking about Lucy and how just like unfit she is. It says, Edward himself, now thoroughly enlightened on her character, had no scruple in believing her capable of the utmost meanness of wanton ill nature. Though his eyes had long been opened, even before his acquaintance with Eleanor began, which I think is very important, to her ignorance and a want of liberty in some of their opinions, they had been equally imputed by him to her want of education. Until her last letter reached him, he had always believed her to be well-disposed, good-hearted girl, and thoroughly attached to himself. So I think this is really important, actually, because first of all, we know that it's not like he saw Eleanor and was like, screw Lucy, like, I'm going to be with this woman. Instead, he was not interested in Lucy even before he met Eleanor. So I think that's important distinction number one. And number two, he wasn't not interested in Lucy when he received this mean letter from her. And that's why he's second helpings or something with Eleanor, sloppy seconds or whatever with Eleanor is the mean way to phrase it.
Wonderful.
But I think those are two very important things that we need to know, because if either of them are the other way, it makes Edward still look like a jerk. So we know that Eleanor is the one that he's always liked better, but he was just going through with this because he had an honor and obligation, and he never liked, you know, he had fallen out of love with her before he met Eleanor, and also like he didn't like Lucy and thought she was fine. And before he got the letter. So I think that's really important, actually, for Edward's characterization and his relationship with Eleanor.
Totally agree. It's funny how, like, all these little details just manage to actually make some things okay, when it was hard for me to reconcile the potential happy endings that we had ahead of us with whatever was happening in the past. I kind of appreciate when Lucy was still trying to hold on to that and go, well, this is my guy. She finally went, yeah, no, I don't want to be that person, you know, second to someone else that you're keeping yourself away from. And I appreciate that Edward seemed to genuinely try to keep their friendship a friendship and platonic because he had Lucy. As opposed to Willoughby, who went, no, I don't really need this in my life. And even though there's a connection here, well, maybe a little bit. Okay, maybe a lot, but like just not all the way. Like 80% of the way there.
That is honestly a fantastic point, that even though I wrote down the quote where he says, like, I felt that I admire you, but I told you it was only friendship, and so I started comparing you to Lucy. I wrote down the quote, but I think you're absolutely right. Like, Edward was having feelings for Eleanor, but tried to keep the distance there that Willoughby didn't. And you're right, that's such an important distinction.
Now I'm thinking, like, remember all the times that Mrs. Dashwood and Marianne complained about how, like, reticent he was at not hiding his feelings. Yes. And oh my God, when we said goodbye, he said goodbye to you like a brother. What yes. is up with that?
Yes. No, you're absolutely right. Oh. This totally makes sense when you look at everything in retrospect. Because we kept being like, does Edward even like Eleanor? And it's like, he did, but he wasn't trying to lead her on like the way Willoughby did. My God, we're like, I'm having this like weird epiphany.
We're retroactively liking Edward.
I know, because I was worried. So I did think, I was like, whatever, this is a Jane Austen book. Eleanor and Edward are going to end up together, probably. But I was worried because up until this point, we thought he liked Lucy. Like, there was nothing that in the text that made me think that he didn't like Lucy. Mm-hmm. And so I was worried. I was like, how does he end up with Eleanor? Is it because Lucy sort of dumps him? And then he, picks up Eleanor.
Which is what happens.
Which is what happens, but I think that we get enough here, Austen gives us enough, where we start to understand and put all the pieces together and really realize that, no, he always liked Eleanor and always preferred her, and Lucy was always a bitch, and and I think we're given enough allowances here to really like Edward, as opposed to just kind of being like, okay, you only wanted Eleanor when you couldn't have her, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it is kind of amazing because Lucy does dump him, but it's not because she just decides he's also too boring or whatever. It's also because she realized, oh no, you belong to someone else. So you don't break up with me, I break up with you.
No, I think we've like really talked through this. I'm like feeling really good about this.
Yeah, we're in a better place now. But I was going to ask you closer to the end of our discussion, but I may as well ask you now because I've had a lot of opportunities to bring it up. Eleanor's ostensibly our hero. She's the person we see everything through her eyes. But do you really think she's like our main protagonist of the story? Part of me is wondering if it's her or if it really is just Marianne and Eleanor just happens to be a side plot who also tells the story.
I think it's, I mean, not to cop out, but I think it's both of them. Like, I think it's a story about both of them. I think, and this is kind of what I wanted to get to at the end of our conversation as well, but the book is called Sense and Sensibility, right? I mean, obviously. And we made a lot of jokes about it in the beginning. We have Eleanor and Marianne are our main characters. Eleanor is the older sister and represents the qualities, quote, sense, like reason, restraint, social responsibility, a clear head, concern of the welfare of others. This is in direct contrast to Marianne, the younger sister, who represents sensibility, emotion, spontaneity, impulsiveness, rapturous devotion to the men, right? We have Eleanor concealing her feelings for Edward. We have Marianne openly and unashamedly proclaiming her passion for Willoughby. And these two different attitudes towards the men that they love and as well as how they express their love, and that really reflects their temperaments. And I was doing some like very basic research, I think mostly on Wikipedia, and this dichotomy between sense and sensibility is also cultural and historical because Austen's writing this novel at the turn of the 18th century. So that's sort of on the cusp of two cultural movements, classicism and romanticism. So you have Eleanor representing like 18th century neoclassicism with rationality, judgment, moderation, balance, propriety, economic practicalities. Like you even have, and there's like a line later in the book where Eleanor's like, where Jane says something like, Eleanor and Edward don't love each other enough to think that they can, like, get by on, like, £300 a year, you know? Like, they're still thinking about, like, economics.
There seems to be, like, a nice balance in their relationship about between romance and being practical.
Oh, yeah. And you have, like, you know, Marianne wants the horse, you know, and Eleanor's like, no, you can't have a horse. But Marianne represents a lot of the qualities emerging out of, you know, romanticism and imagination and idealism and excess and dedication to the beauty of nature. You know, she weeps dramatically when their family departs their old house and willingly offers a lock of her hair. And this this is more of like a romantic sense, and you know, mm-hmm. a lot of the articles that I skimmed over, full disclosure, you know, kind of make the point that this is a depiction of Eleanor and Marianne reflecting the changing literary landscape in the backdrop of the novel. But I don't, it's not really straightforward. It's not that Eleanor doesn't have any passion, right? Because Edward shows up and, you know, tells her that he's not married, and she runs out of the room in tears. You know, Marianne is not always foolish. You know, she's able to learn her lessons. So I don't think that either one of them is the hero, and I don't think either one of them is necessarily the one that we should prioritize over the other. You know, like Eleanor, I think we, because both of us, I think, are a little bit more Eleanor than we are Marianne, I think we both mm-hmm. have the tendency to favor Eleanor's perspective in the way that she handles things. But I think ultimately they both are our protagonists, and we're supposed to view them as sort of a balance.
Balance is exactly the word that was like striking me as you were talking, because it does seem to weirdly find that center between the two of them, because all the action is seemingly happening to Marianne most of the time, but because it's through Eleanor's perspective, you know, through the love that she has for her sister, and because of her nature, of course, Eleanor is going to put her sister's story first and kind of keep pushing her to the side. And I think that's very reflective of who they are as people. So it is easy, certainly, to think that Marianne is more the main character. But then, like, so much of the end is also dedicated to Eleanor. So it's the more I think about, you know, how clever that actually is, mm-hmm. the structure.
Oh, yeah. And I think maybe if neither one of us were maybe a little bit more like Marianne, we might lean more in that perspective as well. So mm-hmm. because we're both Eleanors, that we might prioritize her point of view. And in a way, I think Austin is more like Eleanor, so that's mm-hmm. why it is the way it is. And I think we'll see down the line in other books that Austin's written, there is maybe one clear protagonist, even if the character has sisters. But in this one, it's about Eleanor. I think the original title was like Eleanor and Marianne or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's about them, and they're kind of two sides of the same coin, and they balance each other out really well.
I'm trying to imagine the story if it was told from Marianne's perspective or from a more objective third-person narrative.
Mm-hmm.
The way that that Eleanor sees her sister is so important, because Marianne as a character is kind of annoying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We require that affection and love and seeing, you know, her good heart and everything. But also, that doesn't mean that Eleanor isn't occasionally rolling her eyes and laughing at how ridiculous her sister is, which is still also coming from a place of affection.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it works so well. And I'm mostly just trying to look back at the whole entire book as a whole and how it was written, since it was my first time. And even though we say that sometimes, you know, it seems really simplistic how the story is told and how, you know, 8 million plot points seem to be happening to us and everything gets wrapped up, there is still so much brilliance in how the story is constructed, even though there's so little dialogue, even though there, you know, sometimes everything happens in the exposition.
Yeah, no, it's a kind of a good exercise. And I wonder when we watch, because, you know, spoiler alert, we're going to be talking about some of the adaptions of this novel in our next episode. And mm-hmm. I wonder, because of the nature of film, is mm-hmm. is third person, right? You can't tell a story really from just first person point of view. The camera is an objective viewer. I mean, obviously good directors and everything can make you seem like you're in the POV of a certain character, but in general, film is third person. And so I'll be curious to see how the adaptions, if we view the adaption similarly in that it's both Eleanor and Marianne's story, or if there's an adaption choice to sort of prioritize one story over the other.
And let's not forget, Emma Thompson won an Oscar for writing the adaptation of Sense and Sensibility. And she is a very ardent feminist. Fan of stories, feminist, yeah. and stories and characters. So it's just the integration of all those things and being someone so clever and well-educated. It's really exciting to see how all that's going to come together and how it's going to read now that I finally read the book.
Yeah, and I think, you know, not to say that a man wouldn't be able to properly adapt this work, but mm-hmm. I think a female perspective is sort of necessary in certain ways. I mean, I don't want to say that a man couldn't do it, so I'm not saying that. But it's a story about sisters, and I would be very worried that someone else would take this story and make it about them finding husbands, because it is about that, but it's mostly about the sisters, and it's mostly about the sister relationship. And I think that's why it's such a special story. And I would worry that maybe in lesser hands, the story could become more about getting the man.
I can definitely see that as a genuine concern. And I mean, even some women would fall into that trap as well, or fall into,
yeah, of course,
potentially seeing the two women as competition, or just constantly being catty at each other because they're both being kind of dumb. I don't have any, you know, siblings that I'm close to or anything, but I've had really good friends, girlfriends. So I've had some light sense of what that relation must be like. It's very complicated.
Mm-hmm.
It's very complicated to be so full of love, but also occasionally resent and be annoyed and tolerate and love someone all at the same time on that level, when men are generally, overall, on average, but not individually, not as emotionally intelligent or allowed to share on that level.
Have you, I'm sure you've heard of the Bechdel test, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of simplistic, and there are criticisms against it, but basically it's the measure of the representation of women in fiction. It's based off of American cartoonist Alison Bechdel, and you should see Fun Home and read Fun Home if you haven't. And anyway, it asks whether a work features at least two women who talk to each other about something other than a man, and that they must be named women characters. And you'd be surprised that not a lot of works of fiction actually meet the Bechdel test. And something that I noticed in this book, not that I read or consume any type of fiction and have this is what I'm thinking about all the time, in Sense and Sensibility, and I'll be curious if this is the case in a lot of Austen's work, but I would say that there's never even a time in this book where there's two men talking to each other. Like, there's always like a woman as part of the conversation. I mean, it's alluded to, I think, in chapter 49 or so, that Edward and Colonel Brandon become friends.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, yeah, they become friends and they like each other, but there's never, like, a conversation just between them. The entire book is women talking to women or women talking to men, and it's just, it doesn't even pass, there's not even, a scene where it's two men, talking.
That's kind of amazing.
I know. It's like, Austen's like, I don't really care about the male character.
Yes. It's kind of, because I mean, nowadays you can go through, watch a whole movie or a whole book, and there not be a single female, mm-hmm. and no one notices, and it's totally fine. But there is definitely something about a story where there is just a complete void of men. No offense to Edward and Brandon.
Yeah, and I like Edward and Brandon. I think it's cute. There's some cute quotes there that they have a resemblance in good principles and good sense and disposition and manners, and that, you know, they have humility and they both, you know, love sisters and they're mutual regard.
I did love that.
Yeah.
They're being in love with two sisters and two sisters fond of each other made their mutual regard inevitable and immediate, which might otherwise have weighted the effect of time and judgment. I love that part.
Oh, yeah. I know. It's adorable. Amazing. Yeah. I love the idea that they're best friends and that these sisters married good friends and they hang out together and play charades and all that kind of stuff.
It's the ideal.
Oh, yeah. No, it's adorable. If they have to get married, you know, if the sisters have to get married at the end of the book, which they do because it's a Jane Austen book in the 18th century, then I'm glad that the sisters can, live together and that their husbands love each other, and it's, very cute. But the story isn't about their friendship. It's literally a paragraph in this entire book. When you easily could have, had many scenes of Colonel Brandon and Edward talking, Edward being like, so you like Marianne? You know, there easily could have been, a scene like that, and there's not.
Yeah, occasionally you mostly just had, Willoughby making fun of Brandon behind his back.
Ugh, my God. Still don't like that.
Willoughby. Freaking Willoughby.
Yeah, no, it's I don't know where I think I read it on, some Pride and Prejudice fan Tumblr or something, so I apologize. It's not my idea, but I think it was just something that, because we're talking about this story being between sisters and everything, and I think it's sort of like relevant because, you know, there's it's about the female characters here, and there are ones we like and there's ones we don't like, and there are men we like but more men that we don't like, and it's from,
and there's some people that you are always going to trust, and probably they're women.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true.
I do like that Mrs. Jennings, who was super on Lucy's side when the Ferrers disowned Edward, suddenly changed her tune.
My girl, Mrs. Jennings. And called
Lucy, she called her a worthless hussy, which when I was reading it, I'm like, Mrs. Jennings, that is too far. And then I went, just kidding. She stole Mrs. Jennings' maid's money and abandoned her and ran off to get married and left poor Nancy with, like, no means to pay for her way back. And I went, no, okay, that's fine. You can call her a worthless hussy this
one time. It's awful. Like, Lucy, you suck.
She really does. And it's so, part of me kind of admires the ambition and hustle that Lucy has, because literally her job in life is to be married, and that is what she needs to do to survive and be able to pay her bills. But at the same time, it's because, you know, she does it by being terrible.
Mm.
And she is rewarded for it because the guy she actually ended up marrying in the end is the favorite child of this awful woman and therefore gets all this money in the end.
Oh, my God. Let's talk about Robert for a second. This is going a little ahead than my notes, but Robert sucks.
Robert, what is it? Really sucks. What is it with brothers marrying, like, their brother's woman?
I know. What does it say? He says about Robert, he was proud of his conquest, proud of tricking Edward, and very proud of marrying privately without his mother's consent. So it's like, dang, Robert, you cold. Like,
his relationship with Edward is the complete 100% opposite of Marianne and Eleanor. It is so mean.
Mm-hmm.
He has the audacity to be so critical of Edward, and then he turns around. He's potentially having been courting Lucy behind his back this whole time, or being courted by Lucy, or a little of both. And he just runs off, and it's fine, and it's great, and kind of exciting. Doesn't care about his brother or his feelings, even if he doesn't love Lucy. And in the end, Mrs. Ferrers reluctantly forgives Edward because she's like, well, it could be worse. You could still be marrying Lucy. Are you sure you don't want to marry Miss Morton? Fine, oh, whatever. Marry that other lady.
Mrs. Ferrers has, like, kind of not redeemed herself in my eyes, but some of this stuff here is, like, very funny. Because he's, like, all nervous to, like, talk to her. At first she, like, sees him and she's, like, happy to see him. So you're like, okay, she's not, like, a total horrible person to, like, disown her children and then, like, mm-hmm. stick to that. But then he, like, tells her, and he was listened to with unexpected calmness. Mrs. Ferrers at first reasonably endeavored to dissuade him from marrying Miss Dashwood by every argument or power, but ultimately she judged it wisest from the experience of the past to submit, and therefore with an ungracious delay she owed to her own dignity and has served to prevent every suspension of goodwill, she issued her decree of consent to the marriage of Eleanor and Edward.
And then poor Edward is like, Robert is her favorite anyways, so he'll probably be fine. And he was right.
Yeah.
Edward is this, like, the black sheep of his family by being the least terrible person, by not being an awful person. He is the one who is shunned so easily. But I suppose when you've lost both of your sons due to your own personality, and one of them tries to come back for a reconciliation, you're like, okay, cool, come back. But
And she gives Edward and Eleanor, like, what, £10,000 or something?
Yes, and £250 a year from then on.
Yeah, it was as much, however, as he was desired and more than was expected by Edward and Eleanor, and Mrs. Ferrers herself, by her shuffling excuses, seemed to be the only person surprised at her not giving more.
I really love that line because Edward and Eleanor were already expecting her to be awful.
I mean, I knew because it was, like, you know, a Jane Austen novel and we had, like, 3 pages left or something, that they wouldn't be, like, destitute. So mm-hmm. I figured that, like, they would, like, make up. So it is kind of, like, convenient, if it not at all, like, completely plausible, that she would be, like, fine, like, take your money.
Edward and Robert and Mrs. Ferrers all remind me very much of just, like, every typical image of, like, a narcissist and her kids. Just, there's always, like, the scapegoat, there's always the golden child, and everyone knows who the favorite is, and you have your enablers, which I consider Miss Fanny to be one.
Mm-hmm.
It It's so awful. Mrs. Ferris has at some point lost both of her sons to Lucy. And in the end, Lucy, just through sheer willpower and time, manages to worm her way back into the family and into Mrs. Ferris' good graces. And Robert's back there too. And they deserve each other, frankly.
No, that's true. I mean, good for Lucy. You know, like, it all pretty much, like, ends pretty well for her.
I'm saying, she's got her own story there.
Yeah, we didn't even need to, like, twist our arms to come up with, like, a redemptive arc for Lucy. Like, she kind of just does it for herself, and at the end you just kind of have to be like, well, Eleanor and Marianne ended up where they were supposed to be, so bravo, Lucy. Like, good for you. No ill will.
Yeah, she did, because she did the right thing. She got out of the way of true love.
That's true. Yeah. So, like, I guess at the end of the day, like, good for Lucy. Like, you go, girl. Be Machiavelli.
We're not as kind about Willoughby, though, who also did the right thing and got out of his way of Marianne and Colonel Brandon. Because, one, there wasn't, like, a thing there already. Two, yeah. He did a bunch of horrible things on the way there. Still, we have Lucy and we have Willoughby, who are both fine in the end.
They're both fine, but, I mean, Willoughby gets, like, what, like, a couple, like, paragraphs about how, like, sad he is?
Yes, he does.
Willoughby could not hear of her marriage without a pang, and his punishment was soon afterwards complete in the voluntary forgiveness of Mrs. Smith. He might at once have been happy and rich, that his repentance of misconduct, which thus brought its own punishment, was sincere, need not be doubted, nor that he long thought of Colonel Brennan with envy and of Marianne with regret.
There's this whole part where it's like, well, I mean, you kind of hope that he's sort of suffering and, you know, the world, you know, he gets his comeuppance in the end, but actually he's just fine. And even his relationship isn't like super awful, but at some point he also does, but that he was forever inconsolable, that he fled from society or contracted a habitual gloom of temper or died of a broken heart, must not be depended on, for he did neither. He lived to exert and frequently enjoy himself. His wife was not always out of humor, nor his home always uncomfortable, and in his breed of horses and dogs and in sporting of every kind, he found no inconsiderable degree of domestic felicity. Yeah, so he's fine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's nice to think that he'd get his comeuppance, but no, he's getting by. He's actually quite comfortable.
But Annie.
But yeah. He does still think of Marianne, and he, quote, made her his secret standard of perfection in women. So, I mean, I guess in a way she made him a little bit of a person by... No, I can't do it. I still hate Willoughby.
Yeah. So, speaking of happy endings and unhappy endings... Mm-hmm. Brandon, Colonel Brandon, and Marianne. Let's talk about that.
Yes, I think it's time we went there.
So everybody wants them to be together, and even John Dashwood, and they end up together. And Marianne learns a lot of valuable lessons, and she can never, you know, love in halves, so her whole heart is as devoted as her husband as it once was to Willoughby. Do you buy this? Are you buying what they're selling?
No.
Does Marianne love Colonel Brandon? Like, are they like, what is going on here? Like, they like hang out together and then they're married and they're happily ever after.
I genuinely don't know. I mean, there's a part of me that does see it, you know, that along with the personal growth that she declared after recovering and recognizing how unkind she was to the people around her, including she even, like, at some point she even regrets how she treated, like, how she felt about Fanny, about how she felt about the Steeles, and certainly about Colonel Brandon. So there is a little groundwork laid, I believe, of her opening her eyes and seeing what kind of person Brandon is and what he is for her and the love that he felt for her. But it does seem more like it was manipulated into that situation by the people around her. And at some point, she's just like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to be more practical.
I mean, I like Colonel Brandon. You like Colonel Brandon. What, there's like a line that he's as happy as all who loved him best thought he deserved to be. Like, everybody wants him to be happy. And he loves Marianne. And so the natural conclusion to that is that he's with Marianne, which is great. But he doesn't know Marianne. They've barely talked. He's like loved her from afar. And then at the end, he like, they don't, all of us, they like visit each other a lot. It happens a little too fast for me. I wish we'd gotten, like, a scene where she thanks him for, like, getting her, you know, I just wanted, like, one scene or something more than this, because it just feels a little flat to me.
Yeah, because they don't really even exchange, like, dialogue at any point, which we see with Edward and Eleanor, despite all our many complaints all the time of how little Edward talks in the actual book. Yeah, like you said, just one moment would have been nice. Something. I worry that it falls into the same category where Marianne said earlier, you know, her happiness was never Willoughby's object. And as we've seen multiple times, that is certainly Colonel Brandon's object, but we don't actually see it in action with the two of them interacting and her seeing it and acknowledging it and processing it.
Yeah, and I believe that. Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with a marriage of, like, convenience. Like, it's fine that they're happy together and that he treats her really well and she, you know, they get along. And so I don't think that's a problem. But then Jane throws in a bunch of lines about how, you know, she can't do anything in half. She loves him. And she loves him more than she loves Willoughby, which is fine. And I believe that. But at the same time, it is a little, I don't know. It just strikes me a little bit sudden.
Abrupt?
Yeah, abrupt. Yeah.
It's such a turnaround for Marianne when, at least with Eleanor and Edward, there's something that was there from the beginning. We've built up to it. It's still fairly in line with who they are as people. Marianne, less so.
There's an interesting, and this kind of goes to what we were talking about, growth with Marianne. There's this quote, forgive me, it is a little long. Marianne Dashwood was born to an extraordinary fate. She was born to discover the falsehood of her own opinions and to counteract by her conduct her most favorite maxims. She was born to overcome an affection formed so late in life as at 17, and with no sentiment superior to strong esteem and lively friendship, voluntarily to give her hand to another, and that other man, a man who had suffered no less than herself under the event of a former attachment, whom 2 years before she had considered too old to be married, and who still sought the constitutional safeguard of a flannel waistcoat. I think Austin thinks that a person should be able to remake themselves and to change, and that she's expressing that through Marianne. And so for us as the reader, I might not believe that Marianne loved Brandon the same, but Austin wants us to believe that she does, and I kind of maybe need to just sort of take that for granted and be happy that it ends like as happily as it does.
We're certain, you and I at least, are kind of in a position where we want her to be loved and happy, but we're not super convinced that she is there yet, I guess. Am I supposed to believe that, you know, even back then, the age difference between 17 and 19, somehow she's meant to be
mature
to have mature to have been granted the wisdom that comes with old age. Even some hint of like their actual interaction would have been nice.
Yeah, I just wanted a little something more is all. And then it just sort of like, what do you think of the ending?
In the end, I mean, I'm happy enough because it seems like they have like this really lovely life. They live close together. The sisters can interact. Their mom comes to visit regularly. Margaret gets to be the center of attention from the Jays. That's what I call Sir John and Mrs. Jennings. Because she's like old enough now that they can
parade Margaret.
Around and try to get Margaret. What did I call her?
Oh no, I just forgot about Margaret.
See, it started off as a running joke, but it's not really a joke because I genuinely forget about her.
But there's like a line, a weird line where she'd reached the age highly suitable for dancing and not very ineligible for her supposed to have a lover.
Now they're about to show her off. Well, because their toys have run off to Delaford to live lives like people, so they still need their amusement, I guess. Never change, Mrs. Jennings. Sir John, you could tone it back a bit.
It is, you know, I think ending a book is hard, you know? And it does feel a little abrupt, but it is just very much like, to borrow a phrase from Harry Potter, right? Like, all is well.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think a lot of people, and I've had this conversation with a lot of, you know, mutual friends of ours that, you know, in Harry Potter, like, what does that mean, all is well? Like, it's been 19 years, you know, like, what happened in the interim? Like, aren't these children, like, scarred from spending their, like, younger days, like, fighting evil? And I mean, like, Marianne and Eleanor haven't had to do that. But it is kind of just like, and they lived happily ever after. And you're like, okay.
And it is what you expect when you're reading this book, not just because of the reputation of Jane Austen, but just reading this book, you know, things are going to be, you know, okay.
Mm-hmm.
All these crazy things aren't going to be thrown at them, and it's not just going to be fine.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, they have money and, you know, and you do get like a sense of kind of like what's happening around them. And
in the end, it's also kind of, I mean, I know it's like their livelihood and survival and everything, but it's also kind of like low stakes drama.
No, that's true. No, it's all very low stakes. And I'm happy that it ends happily, and I'm happy that they're happy, and I'm sort of willing to, like, buy it, because that's what sort of story it is.
It's so weird now that we're not going to be living in that world with these sisters anymore.
So what are your thoughts, I mean, now that we're done, really? And I think we've covered a lot, and I think we've actually covered a lot of the themes of the book overall.
I agree.
But, like, what is your overall, like, thought? How do you feel?
I'm already missing it a little bit, partly because we spend so much time with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm going to miss the humor, although I assume that's going to carry on to other books. Is there anything in particular you're going to miss?
Yeah, I mean, I think I will miss Eleanor and I will miss Marianne. You know, my experience with other Austen properties has been very much that they're still a part of me. You know, I still think of them frequently, and it's really opened my eyes to viewing similar stories in, you know, interesting ways, and I feel like it's so rare to like get a fully fleshed out story that's more about interpersonal communication and what it means to really be in love with someone and betrayed by someone. And I feel like it's so subtle and funny, and I miss that sometimes when I'm reading something else that maybe not as well written. And so I think I'll miss that, and I'm lucky that we have other books to explore together.
That's going to be wonderful. I'm definitely going to miss the relationships, for mm-hmm. sure. Colonel Brandon, going to miss him.
Well, yeah.
But I love the ease and humor with which the women interact. Mm-hmm. Many women have very diverse interactions with each other. I'm definitely going to miss that, although I anticipate that continuing on in the future. Do you have an Austen ranking yet?
Of people or?
Of books so far. Because you've read more of them than I have.
Yeah, I mean, no, I'll be interested in exploring them with you, because I think that we're doing a little bit more of a closer reading. And mm-hmm. it's hard because Pride and Prejudice is so ubiquitous and it's so around. And I think that the adaptions color my perception of it as much as the book, even though I actually read the book first before I saw any of the adaptions. So I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it. It's so hard of the ones that I've read. I'm one of the ones that I'm really looking forward to discussing with you is Persuasion. Mm-hmm. I think that I read that when I was a little young to really appreciate it. And so I'm looking forward to going back to that as an older mm-hmm. woman. And I think I'll look at it a lot more fondly and probably put it higher than it currently sits in my rankings. Whereas like Emma's really high for me because I read it when I was so young.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I am sort of deciding still where I want to put this. But I really enjoyed the experience of reading it and delving into it with you. And I think my experience is a lot richer having done that.
Absolutely. I love the perspective that you've brought to this.
Oh, Annie, as you as well. You make such beautiful points.
Too kind. Too kind. No, it's been really fun because so many things that, like, occur to me while reading this book, a lot of them happen just simply like voicing them and working them out with you. So it's been a wonderful journey. I am looking forward to hearing what you have to say about other books you have also read before. And because I know you haven't read all of them, right?
No, I haven't.
So that's also going to be a really fun adventure.
Yeah. So do you have anything more you want to say about this book? I think we already kind of covered our burn candidates. I don't know if you have. There was, like, one line about Mrs. Jennings where, like, She was summoned to her chaise to take comfort in the gossip of her maid for the loss of her two young companions.
Oh, yeah.
And now I know what the gossip with the maid was, and I'm, like, very mad about it.
Lord. You know what? I would watch a, like, miniseries spinoff of Mrs. Jennings and her gossip corner. There was one that we mentioned earlier, and I already forgot what it is now. But I did have the part where Lucy told Edward to burn all that she has burnt all his letters.
Oh, yeah.
That was really funny. The whole letter that she wrote to Edward in general was kind of a gem. It's possibly my favorite thing in the book because it is so awful. Being very sure I have long lost your affections, I have thought myself at liberty to bestow my own on another and have no doubt of being as happy with him as I once used to think I might be with you. But I scorn to accept a hand while the heart was another's.
Burn.
To which I say, kind of you go girl, but at the same time,
yeah. I think I still like Edward being like, ugh, I didn't know what attractive girls were until.
So rude, Edward. But it's nice to see a little bit more personality from him.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, I have a couple of like fun facts before we go on.
Ooh, let's do it.
So apparently the first edition of Sense and Sensibility was said to only be by a lady. And then the second edition only said by the author of Pride and Prejudice. So only her immediate family, only Austen's immediate family knew that she wrote the books and that she published anonymously so she didn't have to like deal with popularity. And it made her really private because writing and being in the public space was associated with a loss in femininity. And so she used to hide when she'd be writing from people when they entered. And so the first printing of the novel sold out. It was 750 copies.
That's amazing, actually.
Yeah. So I thought that was really, it was only said to be by a lady.
By a lady. I mean, I'm sure that's probably been the intent where people thought this probably had a male writer and they're just saying it's a lady for promotional purposes.
Oh, yeah. So those are my facts. I'm sure I could find more if I did more research, but you know, life in this episode is getting very long.
So now that we've finished with the book, before we continue on until Pride and Prejudice, for next episode, we are going to be taking in certain adaptations.
Yes, next week is our next 2 weeks, whatever, is our adaptation episode.
So we'll be doing the Emma Thompson version, starring her and Kate Winslet and Hugh Grant and the incomparable Alan Rickman, who I will always speak of in hushed, reverent tones.
Yeah. So this is the 1995 version by Ang Lee as the director. So
95.
I don't think it's streaming anywhere, but you can rent it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worth renting. So, or get it from the library.
I was going to say, I highly doubt there isn't a library that doesn't have this somewhere.
Yeah.
Not only, though, are we going to be watching that, we're also going to be watching the BBC miniseries from 2008.
Well, I'm sorry. I had the IMDb page open because I wanted to be really specific because there are other miniseries of Sense and Sensibility. We're choosing the 2008 one because it's available to stream on Prime and it's only 3 hours. The other one's like 9 hours or something. And this one has Dominic Cooper and Dan Stevens. And then, you know what else is available to stream on Prime? A movie called Sense and Sensibility from 2011.
S-E-N-T-S.
Yes. And you guys don't have to watch it because it has like a 5 out of 10 rating on IMDb.
That sounds like you probably should watch it though.
So I will be watching this because I won't be able to help myself. Two sisters find that they have to make their own way in the world after their father is jailed. Eleanor is a cleaner in a spa, and Marianne works for a marketing company, but she also makes scented lotions.
That description is completely bonkers. I don't even know.
So I'll be watching this. And so you don't have to, but I will.
I may have. I mean, it's on Prime.
Yeah, it's only an hour and a half. So anyway, so we'll be watching those and talking about them. So watch them along with us.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to all of that with you next episode.
But yeah, I'm really excited to watch with you and talk about it with you. And
compare, contrast, see if anything gets anything better or wrong. And at the same time, we get to be smug book readers of the book was better.
Oh, so true. So true.
It's the greatest joy that a book reader can have.
I try to do it all the time. And then, but sometimes it ruins the enjoyment, so I don't think that'll be the case here.
No, not at all. So, until next time, where can people find us, Jessie?
We have a website that Annie made called thedailynightly.com. Nightly is spelled, remember, K-N-I-G-H-T-L-E-Y. We have a Goodreads account that we never update. We have a Twitter at nightlypod, an Instagram.
Also don't update it.
Yeah, an Instagram, thedailynightly. And an email, thedailynightly@gmail.com. Feel free to email us and tell us your thoughts about the adaptions, your experiences with Sense and Sensibility. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the book overall if you've been reading along with us.
Yes, and now that we've finished our very first book of our podcast, please feel free to reach out to us. Let us know what you liked, what you didn't like, any suggestions for the future. We would love to hear from you. And you guys may be hearing from some friends of ours in the future, too.
I guess instead of happy reading, we have to say happy watching.
I guess so. Before we do, want to give a special shout out to Kevin MacLeod for our awesome music that we love so much. And until then, guys, happy watching.
Happy watching. Yay.